resorting to petty gossip, and I was grateful to sit with them, though I could have lived without the unobstructed view of Charlotte and Evan's lunchtime foreplay dates. On Thursday night, I had a meeting with Ms. Welsh, my advisor, one of those mandatory things for seniors. Of course, I was late, since I'd left my math notebook in the waiting room at my physical therapist's and didn't realize until I was halfway to campus. Ms. Welsh was nice enough, even about my being late. And so I settled into the world's hardest chair in her office and smiled attentively and listened as she lectured me on the importance of maintaining one's extracurriculars during senior year and reaching out to teachers well in advance for college recommendations. I didn't have the heart to tell her that maintaining my extracurriculars was literally physically impossible, or that I suspected Mrs. Martin might decorate my recommendation letter with grape-scented Fiesta Snoopy stamps. By the time I finally made my escape, after promising to check out some close-to-home colleges I wasn't particularly interested in attending, I was feeling pretty exhausted by the idea of college applications in general. I'd never really thought I'd have to deal with them. It was a given that I'd be recruited to play somewhere, probably one of the nearby state colleges. My father used to tell me stories about his college fraternity, and how future employers would be impressed if I became president of my frat house. I'd pictured it easily back then, my whole planned-out life. College athlete, fraternity president, getting some suit and tie job after school and cruising up the Big Bear or Tahoe on the weekends with my friends. There was more, but you get the idea. The perfectly generic life for the perfectly generic golden boy. Ezra? Someone called, derailing my train of thought. It was Cassidy, coming down the stairwell from the 400 building in this blue sundress that perfectly matched her eyes. Oh, hey, I said, attempting a smile. A college advisor meeting? Unfortunately, Mr. Choi doesn't have a sense of humor. I've heard he enjoys jokes where the punchlines are mathematical equations, I offered. Yeah, he seems like the sort of guy who would get off on a tangent. I snorted. That's terrible. Cassidy shrugged as we fell into step toward the parking lot. It was getting late. The whole world had darkened while I was in Ms. Welsh's office. The stadium lights were on, bathing the campus in an orange glow and casting the hills into shadow. Tomorrow's Friday, Cassidy said, as though I needed reminding. Wonder what all the cool kids are doing this weekend. Jimmy's having a party tomorrow night. I'd give it 2 hours before someone gets drunk enough to toss the keg into the pool. Oh, wow, that sounds super fun, Cassidy rolled her eyes. Well, what did you do on Friday nights before you moved here? She shook her head and launched hesitantly into a rambling story about secret parties in the science labs of her boarding school. We'd all have to sneak in and out of the dorms through the old steam tunnels. It was like this mark of prestige if you got burned on one of the old pipes. I think one of my brother's friends started it back in the day. I don't know, it sounds dumb talking about it. No, it doesn't sound dumb. Jimmy's back-to-school backyard kegger sounded dumb, only I didn't say anything. The campus was peaceful at night, surrounded by the gentle slope of the hills, with just the two narrow lanes leading back to town. The hills were covered with hundreds of avocado trees, and every once in a while, a coyote would wander down and terrorize the residents of some nearby gated community. That was what excited people around here, getting together a mob to shoo the coyote back into the avocado groves, to remove the interloper from our perfect little planned community. No one went looking for adventure. They chased it away. When we reached the student lot, there was only my Volvo, Justin Wong's souped-up Honda, and a truck with a surfboard strapped on top. Where's your car? I asked. Cassidy laughed. My bike is right here. Sure enough, a lone red bicycle was locked to the rack. It was a decent bike, a rebuilt Cannondale, but I didn't know much about bikes then. Huh, I said, staring at it. What? Nothing. I tried not to grin at the image of Cassidy pedaling past the strawberry fields on a bicycle. I'll have you know that I care about the environment, Cassidy said hotly. I'm doing my best to reduce my carbon footprint. I thought about this for a moment. Carpooling reduces your carbon footprint, doesn't it? I asked. Yes. So, would you like a ride home? I don't know where the offer came from, but it suddenly seemed presumptuous. There are these coyotes, I said, awkwardly filling the silence. They come down from the hills sometimes at night, and I don't want you to get attacked.
Coyotes?
Cassidy frowned. Aren't those like wolves?
Nocturnal wolves, I clarified.
You're sure you don't mind?
I offered, didn't I?
All right,
Cassidy relented. I had an unfortunate fit of chivalry and told Cassidy to get into the car while I dealt with her bike. Damn near killed me, too, getting that thing into the trunk.
Thank you,
she said when I climbed into the driver's seat.
No problem.
I reached for my seatbelt.
So, where do you live?
Terrace Bluffs?
That's no trouble. I live in Rosewood. I'm right next to you on the loop. She buckled her seatbelt, and I threw the car into reverse, realizing how intimate it was with just the two of us and the empty rows of parking spaces.
Rosewood's the section across the park, isn't it?
She asked.
Yeah, my bedroom looks out over it.
So does mine.
Cassidy grinned.
Maybe we can see into each other's bedrooms.
I'll remember to close the blinds next week when I commit a double homicide, I promised, flashing my brights on the blind curve out of the foothills.
I like you like this,
Cassidy said.
Like what?
I asked as I merged onto Eastwood Boulevard.
Talking. You hold back if there are too many people around.
I put on my turn signal, in case a coyote was curious which way I wanted to turn at the deserted intersection, and thought about this. The way I figured it, keeping quiet was safe. Words could betray you if you chose the wrong ones, or mean less if you used too many. Jokes could be grandly miscalculated, or stories deemed boring, and I'd learned early on that my sense of humor and ideas about what sorts of things were fascinating didn't exactly overlap with my friends.
I don't hold back, I protested. I just don't have anything interesting to say.
Cassidy looked skeptical.
Yeah, sorry, not buying it. You have this maddening little smile sometimes, like you've just thought of something incredibly witty but are afraid to say it in case no one gets the joke.
I shrugged and turned left onto Crescent Vista, catching the traffic light that made 2 minutes last even longer than they did in Coach Anthony's class.
Actually, I don't know which is worse,
Cassidy mused,
when people laugh at things that aren't funny or when they don't laugh at things that are.
The first one, I said darkly. Just ask Toby.
What, you mean the severed head thing?
She said it exactly like that, as though we might have been talking about irregular verbs or the Pledge of Allegiance.
He told you?
Last year at some debate tournament. We were sitting out on the balcony under a tent we'd made from bedsheets, and I'd mentioned how I'd never been to Disneyland. I think it's hilarious. I called him the Catcher on the Ride for ages.
I shook my head over her terrible pun and turned on the radio, trying not to think about Cassidy and Toby keeping each other company late at night in hotel rooms, probably in their pajamas. The shins drifted through the speakers, and I waited for Cassidy to say something as we sat at that endless light. But she didn't. Instead, she picked up a straw wrapper I'd stuffed into the cup holder and began to fold it into a little origami star.
Make a wish,
she said, cupping the little star in the palm of her hand. The glow of the streetlight washed over her, and it struck me, almost as an afterthought, that she was beautiful. I don't know how I'd missed it those first few days, but I knew it then. Her hair was thrown back into a ponytail, with these copper-colored pieces framing her face. Her eyes shone with amusement, and her sweater slipped off one shoulder, revealing a purple bra strap. She was achingly effortless, and she would never, in a million years, choose me. But, for the next few minutes, I contented myself with the magnificent possibility that she might. The gate guard outside Cassidy's subdivision gave me the third degree, which, incidentally, is the sort of burn that can kill. When he was finally satisfied that we weren't about to wreak havoc on the unsuspecting suburban streets, he opened the gate, and I drove through into Terrace Bluffs. It wasn't that different from my subdivision. The houses were all set back from the street, with circular driveways and balconies that weren't really supposed to be used. There were only four models, like a computer animation that kept repeating. Some little kids had been drawing in the street with chalk, and I felt terrible as I drove over it, as though I was wrecking a second grader's sandcastle.
"How do I get to your house?" I asked.
"Do you ever just not want to go home?"
Her face was pale in the lamplight, and I could see it in her eyes that she was serious.
"Yeah, absolutely," I admitted, even though it was pretty personal. I thought about my mom sitting in the family room, watching the news and worrying over everything. About my father in his home office, a mug of tea going cold at his elbow as he typed out another brief. About my bedroom, which felt as though it wasn't mine anymore after I'd spent 3 months sleeping in the downstairs guest room.
"I have an idea," Cassidy said. "How about we go somewhere right now?"
"It's Eastwood," I said. "There's nowhere to go."
"Let's go to the park,"
Cassidy pleaded.
"You can point out your bedroom window, and I can point out mine."
"All right," I said, reversing over the chalk drawings.
The gate guard gave me a dirty look when I pulled through, and Cassidy laughed and flipped in the bird when we were too far away for him to see.
"I freaking hate that guy," she said. "Do you read Foucault?"
"What am I talking about? Of course you don't read Foucault."
"Mostly I just don't read," I deadpanned, making Cassidy laugh.
"Well, Mr. Illiterate Jock, let me enlighten you. There was this philosopher slash historian called Foucault, who wrote about how society is like this legendary prison called the Panopticon. In the Panopticon, you might be under constant observation, except you can never be sure whether someone is watching or not, so you wind up following the rules anyway."
"But how do you know who's a watcher and who's a prisoner?" I asked, pulling into the empty parking lot.
"That's the point. Even the watchers are prisoners. Come on, let's go on the swings."
She was already out of the car before I could even put on the handbrake.
Wait, I called.
Cassidy turned around, her dress rippling in the warm Santa Ana winds. I locked the car and stood there, awash in embarrassment.
"I don't think I can go on the swings," I admitted.
"Then you can push me."
She took off toward the small playground and the bright plastic playset as though we were running a race. I stepped cautiously into the sandbox, feeling my cane sink into the sand like a beach umbrella. Cassidy kicked off her sandals and tied her sweater around her waist. Sitting there on the swing set, in her bare feet and blue dress, her hair slipping out of its ponytail, she was so gorgeous that it hurt.
"Go on,"
she said, twisting on the swing so that the chains made an X.
"Push."
I laid my palms against her back, touching bare skin. I gulped and gave her a push, nearly losing my balance before I figured out how to manage it.
"Keep going," she called.
I kept going. She rose higher and higher on the swing, and to be honest, I was rising a bit myself. After a while, she didn't need me anymore. She was just up there, impossibly high, the chain slapping against the top bar. She tilted her head back, grinning at me.
"We'll escape the Panopticon together," she promised.
And then she jumped. The swing buckled as she flew forward, laughing and shouting. She landed unsteadily on her feet at the edge of the sandbox.
"Did we escape?" I called.
"Not even close."
I sat down on the swing, hoping that would disguise my problem. Cassidy took the other swing, making a complicated design in the sand with her toes.
"Do you see that house just to the right of the tallest tree?" I asked, breaking the silence.
"With the two chimneys?"
"Yeah. My bedroom's the one with the fake balcony. It's right above our pool with the fake waterfall," I added, earning one of Cassidy's rare smiles.
"I'll send you secret messages," she promised, "in Morse code, with my Hello Kitty flashlight."
"You better."
Suddenly, Cassidy's phone buzzed. She slipped it out of her pocket, and I glimpsed a list of missed calls.
"I should get back," she said, standing up. "Pop your trunk so I can get my bike."
I don't mind driving you."
Cassidy shook her head.
"I'd rather bike. It's like my mom's already pissed. I'm not used to living at home, and I forgot to check in."
"Well, if you're sure."
"I'll see you at school,"
she said, and then grinned evilly.
"Unless I'm attacked by nocturnal wolves, in which case you'll just have to live with the guilt."
She scooped up her shoes, and I watched her silhouette as she ran across the grass. and I thought about how it usually wasn't like this when it came to me and girls. 9. I suppose I'd better explain about Charlotte Hyde and how we'd started dating. I asked her to be my girlfriend in October of our junior year, during a scorcher of a weekend when we'd all driven out to Laguna Beach for the day. It was the usual crew piled into the usual cars, about 15 of us. Jimmy had packed the cooler of beers, bought with his older brother's ID. In typical Jimmy fashion, he'd forgotten to bring anything that might disguise the open containers, so the guys kept sneaking them into the public toilets. The cops parked out on Beach Boulevard must have thought they all had the shits. The girls wanted to sunbathe, as usual. They rarely did anything besides recline in beach chairs and flick through magazines, and it baffled me how anyone could go to the beach to willingly engage in the same pass-the-time activities that passengers suffered through on airplanes. The seniors in our crowd put Evan and me to work grilling hot dogs on a public barbecue near the lifeguard stand. Evan complained about being a grunt, but I honestly didn't mind. It was peaceful standing there, the heat from the coals drying my bathing suit, the sun slanting off the water. It was the beginning of junior year, and we had everything to look forward to. After we ate the hot dogs on hamburger buns, "No one fucking told me what kind of buns," Evan had protested, and the girls pretended to be upset over it. Brett Masters, the captain of the water polo team, challenged the tennis guys to 5-on-5 volleyball. They destroyed us because, unlike tennis, water polo plays all on the same court and knows how to pass the damn ball. I'd managed a pretty spectacular spike out of sheer luck, but Jimmy and Evan were drunk enough that it was actually entertaining to watch them fumble and curse at their own ineptitude. The sun had begun to set during the game, the ocean breeze turning cold. The girls put back on their sundresses. Charlotte unhooked her bathing suit top and removed it from beneath her dress, as if by magic. She caught me looking and grinned, sensing that I was under her spell.
"Ezra, come over here,"
she demanded, pouting cutely. Dutifully, I went.
"Jill and I found this quiz in Pop Teen magazine about how to tell if a guy likes you," she said.
And before I knew it, the girls had trapped me on their matching hot pink towels and were making me take the quiz from their magazine. The questions were ridiculous, and when we finally reached the last one, Charlotte insisted on looking up my horoscope.
"Love is in the cards for all of you stubborn Tauruses,"
she told me, and then frowned.
"Well, what do you think?"
"I think I just learned the plural form of Taurus," I joked, and Charlotte pretended to be upset that I wasn't taking the horoscope seriously. Ever since the end of sophomore year, I'd suspected that Charlotte liked me, but that day at the beach was the first time I sensed that she wasn't just flirting for the fun of it, that she had something specific in mind.
"You're so sweet,"
she murmured, leaning into my shoulder as we sat side by side on her towel.
"It's a shame you're not over Stacy."
Stacy Guffin and I had broken up a month earlier, for reasons I didn't fully understand and didn't particularly care to. She'd traumatized me with a Sex and the City DVD marathon when I thought I was going over to her house for, something more orgasmic than shoes. Maybe she'd just wanted to break up so she could have an ex-boyfriend to complain about to her friends. I honestly didn't know. "Trust me," I said, glancing down at the long blonde hair piled on top of her head and her endless tanned legs dusted with a fine layer of sand. "I'm definitely over Stacy." I didn't know much about Charlotte back then, just that she was gorgeous and sexy and always had gum in her purse that she'd offer me with a smile, like she'd brought it just for me. I didn't know that she listened to her iPod in the kitchen while she made elaborate cookies and cupcakes from gourmet baking blogs, or that she thought it was bad luck to eat the batter. I didn't know that she had danced since she was 3, that she did yoga with her mom before school, or that she collected everything to do with ladybugs. I didn't know that we'd be together for more than 8 months, the longest relationship I'd have in high school. We wound up taking a walk to the other end of the beach, where the rocks jutted into the surf, forming little tide pools. She wore my Eastwood tennis sweatshirt because she'd gotten cold. I was secretly glad, since it made her seem more real somehow, the way she kept pushing up the sleeves of my hoodie as we walked through the tidal foam. We scrambled onto the rocks, the barnacles stabbing into the soles of our feet. In the distance, I could see our friends beginning to pack up, and it filled me with a strange sense of urgency. I watched Evan heft the cooler, dumping its contents over